Thanks for downloading this episode of Cork Talk with me, Tim Atkin. A weekly conversation with some of the most famous people in the world of wine.
This podcast is brought to you in partnership with Nomacork by Vinventions. Driven by a commitment to innovation, the new plant-based Nomacork Green Line offers significant improvements in wine closure performance. Thanks to a rigorous oxygen ingress rate, you can decide which cork is best for your wine, whether it's for young and fresh wines or for those with aging potential.
Author, master of wine and owner of three chateaux with her husband Jacques Tiampon, Fiona Morrison is a wonderfully dynamic presence on the Bordeaux wine scene. Listen to us talk about her book, 10 Great Wine Families, what it's like running Le Pin, one of the most famous wine estates in the world, the intricacies of the Napoleonic Code, and how her sense of humour helps her stay honest to herself. Hi, Fiona, how are you?
Really well. Lovely to hear you, at least.
Well, fantastic. Likewise. I mean, I assume you're in Bordeaux, aren't you? Because it's vintage time.
It is vintage time. It's going to be a long and rocky road. It's not a deck chair vintage this year. It's going to be quite challenging, but we did get in some really beautiful young vine grapes on Saturday, which looked really good. So it's not going to be a black and white harvest this year.
I mean, there's been a lot of kind of doom and gloom about, you know, with the frost this year, and it's been a wet
mildew,
wet summer, frost more in Bordeaux, in Burgundy rather than Bordeaux.
But we're going to be able to make some great wines because with all the tools that we've got in front of us and with, you know, everything we know about climate change. But it's not going to be a vintage of a century. Sorry, guys.
I thought there were two of those every decade these days in Bordeaux, aren't there?
Oh, no, at least five. Remember, there's no bad vintage in Bordeaux.
Exactly.
We have useful vintages. We have useful vintages. We have restaurant vintages. But we have no bad vintages anymore.
I mean, I suppose in a way that because you've got things like sorting tables and, you know, you can throw away bad grapes. I mean, in the 50s, presumably, people just put everything in the vat, didn't they, in those days? Or a lot of people did.
Oh, I mean, I've just been reviewing some of the classic edition books for the Académie du Vin Library. Mm. And I mean, you know, it's amazing what they did or what they didn't do. Everything went in.
Well, we probably had no choice.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think the problem is these days is taking it too far.
Yes.
And, you know, this parcel selection and everything. And, you know, we're not haute couture winemaking. We are there to make beautiful wines. But, you know, there's got to be enough for people to drink.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, no, I agree with you. Look, loads of stuff to talk to you about. I mean, parties, university, Le Pin, how you met your husband, all sorts of stuff. But I always do this, and I quite like finding out where people came from, in a sense. And you were born in the States to British parents, although you often talk about yourself as Scottish. I mean, you're proudly Scottish. You now have a Belgian passport. I just wonder, was wine part of your life growing up?
The Scots are great because it's really cold up there, so the cellar conditions are wonderful. And they're not mean, but they are careful. And so opening up great bottles of wine doesn't happen every day. And my father inherited from his father a really good wine cellar. And so Sunday lunches were the times that he used to bring out really good bottles at the time when we were probably far too young to drink wine. But the stories around the wines were so compelling that we just all loved them. And, you know, when you have such enthusiasm and storytelling around a Sunday lunch table, you know, you can't help being hooked into the drawn into story. You know.
Did he do it the French way and water it down?
No, we did it the Scottish way, straight up.
And is it true you asked for a wine book for Christmas when you were 14?
Yeah, because I wanted to hear about these stories. And bless her soul, I think my father got me Pamela Van Dyke Price's book. But, I mean, it was great. I got it in my stocking. It was wonderful. It was, and it wasn't too much about sort of grape varieties. And it was about stories, which is, to me, so much more important than what the blend is of a grape or whatever.
Yeah, and I love the way stories run through your writing and your life and you know, and the way you react to wine is emotional in lots of ways, I think, and that's part of the stories. I mean, it's no coincidence that you studied literature, not wine or sciences at the University of Exeter. I just wonder, how did you move into the wine business and why did you choose the communications end of it to start with?
Well, at university, there was this incredible wine club that had been going for years and years. And we were a rival to Bristol. So there were two great wine merchants in Bristol. There was Avery's and there was Ted Hale. And so we got Ted Hale as a tutor for us for the Hepworth Trophy, which we won, which was wonderful. It was a university, inter-university wine challenge. And I discovered I actually could taste wines blind. And that started me off. My father then said, no daughter of mine is going to go into the wine business. You'll never make a living. You'll only be a secretary. Go off to the States and go and work in publishing or something. So I dutifully did that for about a nanosecond. And then I started over there. I started writing about wine because we were just at the end of a two martini lunch and people were discovering something called wine. And I was there at the moment. I was in the room when it happened. And, I just started writing about what I could, you know, what I had been told and the stories that I could. And I'd done a few vintages already. Hmm. So it actually came very easily to me. And communications is just about telling stories, honestly. Hmm. And I've been doing that ever since.
Yeah. I mean, you list a number of prominent and very different men as your mentors. Tony Tolato of Paterno Imports, Ab Simon, famous Ab Simon of Seagram's Chateau Estates, and in Bordeaux, Jean-Michel Caz, Jean-Claude Berouet, of formerly of Chateau Petrus, of course, and Peter Vinding Diers. Were they right in what they told you as mentors? And what advice would you give your younger self today, do you think, looking back?
I don't know if they were completely right, but they were compelling. And they were willing to talk to a young person about what they knew, which is fantastic. And that's what we should all be doing. Us who are at the other side of a career now, we should be doing that to everyone every stagiaire who works for us during the harvest and everything. What I loved was their accessibility. And, you know, at that age, you are absolutely bombarding people with questions.
Yeah.
And you are really trying to get information. And someone like Ab Simon was such an imposing person that you just learnt by example. I remember being with him when he confronted Michel Delon of Les Valiscas and told him that his 1986 was far too expensive and he wouldn't buy it. It's one of the big clashes that happened in Bordeaux. And the way he did it was in such a courtesy, a courtly, elegant manner that actually took the sting out of things. But it's taught me, so many people have taught me a lot. Mm. And I think for the young people starting out, get as many mentors and as many people, you know, that you can to help you along the way, because it really, really helps.
And ask questions, I think. And don't be afraid to ask what you think are stupid questions, right?
Absolutely.
You, I mean we. Because
yeah,
all questions
no,
are stupid.
We all, every stupid question. And I think one of the things sometimes today that I'm surprised about is that when young people come to us, they tend to tell you a statement rather than ask a question.
Yeah. Yes, I think that's very true. Tell us the wonderful story about how you met your husband, Jacques, who's one of my favourite people, wonderful sense of humour, such a dry sense of humour. He could almost be a Brit.
Yeah, he's an adopted Brit.
Well, had you tasted Le Pin before you met him?
Tim, that's the best story out. You and I have been friends for a long time, and I was doing PR and communication for the Bordeaux Wine Council. And I remember you coming to Bordeaux, and you looked as if you were the cat who had drunk the milk, because you just come from Le Pin. And I remember saying to you, you jammy bastard, I've never been anywhere near Le Pin, for goodness sake. You know, and you said, no, look. And it must have been not more than 2 years later that I finally met Jacques. I was a great friend of his cousin, Bernadette, who was actually studying for BMW at the same time as I was in Paris. Unfortunately, she didn't get it. But she was always talking about Jacques. And she was also talking to Jacques a lot about me. And it took about 5 years for us to meet. But when we did, I was invited the next day to ceremonially come and taste Le Pin, finally. So I got there behind you, but after you. I hit the jackpot.
He certainly did, I think. I mean, the Tiempons are a very prominent wine family in lots of ways. I mean, just what was it like marrying into a family like that? I mean, I've heard that your relatives initially referred to you as la pièce apportée, the addition. I'm pretty sure they've changed their mind by now, haven't they?
Well, I can sometimes qualify as being la valeur ajoutée.
Oh, that's better.
The extra advantage or the extra value. It's quite tough. It's a big clan and it's a very proud clan. And I've had to sort of fight my corner and work very hard and show my worth. But it's a wonderful family. People take their sense of history, their sense of duty for the family, and also their sense of making great quality wines and the reputation of the family extremely seriously. And it's something that we preserve for the next generations, which are, of course, now coming into the business behind us.
I mean, they have Belgian origins, obviously. And so did you learn Flemish, didn't you, as well?
I know. God, that's a proof. It's an absolute proof of my love for my darling husband, because it's not a language that was on my sort of list, my bucket list. But anyway, we live in a family house, actually, where the family have been since 1612, which is great. And it's in the sort of lovely countryside near Ghent, which is the only hilly part of Flanders. And we are all bicycling mad. The whole family,
Most of
Belgium.
One of the few hilly bits of Flanders, I'd have thought.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, Le Pin is one of the most famous and sought-after wines in the world, and yet it wasn't always so, was it? I mean, you know, I just wonder, what factors do you think contributed to its meteoric rise?
Well, I think when Jacques bought it in 1979, it was known as being a good soil, but it was being made by a wine producer in Montagne Saint-Emilion for this widow. And I think his Montagne wines were much better than his Le Pin wine was. I think there's a lot of sort of cross-referencing of grapes going across various appellations. But it was pretty primitive in the beginning. Mm. And I think that the soil hasn't changed at all, but I think that Merlot is a grape that needs a lot of care and a lot of attention. And that with a bit of marketing doesn't help. Not marketing to go around. It was the marketing happened completely as a fairy tale. It didn't happen. There was nothing planned. Jack, as you know, is really humble and modest. Mm. And we look at the prices and we think, oh my God, they've passed me the hose. Let's be very careful about this one.
Do you think, oh, I'm not sure if I can afford to open my own wine sometimes?
Oh, well, I mean, once it's in bottle, it's beyond our means. That's why we're always seen with a pipette.
I mean, is the story true that once upon a time it was sold through Augustus Barnett, I think, and not when you guys were involved, obviously, but in the old days. I think it was a good value in an off-license in the UK.
Yeah, you had to ask Roy Richards because he was the first merchant to bring it into England. But Jean Sanders, who is Véronique Sanders' grandfather, had the exclusive rights to Le Pin. And so most of it went to northern France and Belgium, as wines of Pommel did in those times. But if anyone offers us a bottle of Chateau Dupin, as it was called, pre-1979, we decline very gracefully. Thank you very much.
Well, even as a gift?
Oh, well, we've tried some, I mean, it really is, it's very, it's historic vinegar.
I mean, as well as Le Pin, you also own with Jacques Leaf in Saint-Emilion, Lettre in Castillon. Yep. Just tell us briefly how the three differ in style.
Well, they're three trees. You know, Le Pin is a pine tree, Leaf is a yew tree, and Lettre is a beech tree. That sort of ties in with our whole idea of how much we love nature and trees and everything like that. And it's just, again, you know, we don't plan anything. It just opportunities come up. And Jack had the opportunity in 2010 to buy this beautiful parcel of land just below Tropelon Mondo. And he went out in the evening in the winter and looked at it pretty much with his torch and shook hands with the owner. And it was called Au Planté, which was one of those instantly forgettable names. So we had to find a name for it, a tree. And Castillon was a bit like that. I remember cousin Nicolas, who makes the wines at Puigoro, a beautiful estate that the family have at the Côte de France, who showed us to us, and it was owned by Belgians. And he said, rather like sort of Odysseus and Eurydice, he said, do not look left. Whatever happens, do not look left. Of course, we both looked left. And there was this incredible rolling countryside with pastures and trees and sheep and everything. And it was completely un-Bordeaux. in the most beautiful part of the world of Castillon. And we just thought that anyone making wine in such an incredible place must be okay.
It's going to
see and things. It's and so that came our third place. But I think probably we've got our hands full enough at the moment.
That's it.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Merlot is the dominant grape in all of those wines, and it's the dominant grape of the right bank of Bordeaux, obviously. Do you think it sometimes gets a bit of a bad rap in After Sideways, where one of the heroes are so rude about it? Do people underappreciate Merlot?
Oh, when I go to California and they sort of talk about it, you know, I say, well, I make wine. Oh, really? What do you 100% Merlot. Oh, you poor bastard. And I say, well, actually, we do okay. It works for us. But, you know, I mean, California is hot. Mm. It's warm. And I actually, great sweeping statement perhaps, but I haven't really tasted many great Merlots in California. It's just too hot and the grape gets too ripe.
I don't know, is it any? Maybe duck horn in the old days?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Something like that, you know, or Rusper or something like that. Hmm. But it works in Pommerol. It works in Pommerol, so, you know, we're happy.
Because of the clays, do you think?
Well, I mean, people think of Pommerol being clay because of Petrus, but we have a big layer of gravel on top of the clay. And so it's sort of an insurance policy because we do rather well in bad years. Mm. Of course, sorry, I said no bad years in Pommerol, in Bordeaux, but wet years. And so we need, you know, we need the clay and the richness that comes up from the soil to counterbalance the rather thick clays. Merlot is a bit like a bit of a showgirl. You know, it will get so much alcohol and so much richness. I remember going to when I was working for CIVB, going to Tokyo and describing the difference between Merlot and Cabernet Sauvignon as Marilyn Monroe and Arnie Schwarzenegger, something that had sort of stuck, unfortunately, when the best sommelier of the world told me that he'd been at the first wine tasting class he ever did was mine, and he heard that. I knew I was on the right track. But there is a sort of blousy, rich, opulent, extravagant, you know, slightly tarty quality about Merlot that you have to tame. You have to be able to calm that down. And so you can't go crazy with winemaking either.
I mean, Merlot is also an earlier ripening grape variety than Cabernet Sauvignon, obviously, which is one of its benefits, or has been in the past in Bordeaux. I just wonder now, with climate change, not so much this year, but we've had a run of much hotter, warmer vintages, how that's affecting Bordeaux. And do you think the region is reacting fast enough, really, to the challenges that it's presenting?
I think we took a long time to get going, but that's the same for a lot of things in Bordeaux, because Bordeaux is quite risk-averse. Mm. It's such a big region. But it's a juggernaut, so it takes time for things going. But now that it's going, there's so many studies, it's really quite exciting. And we're all working really hard about it. On the right bank, because we're small estates, we can be much more agile and flexible. Mm. So we're doing all sorts of work with the microbial life around the root system to make sure that the growth is carried out, lengthened, so that there's not so much uptake of sugar, of energy. Obviously, the pruning systems have changed a great deal. We are not doing much green harvests because we don't want really concentrated grapes. We want
or leaf plucking, you know, things like that.
Or leaf plucking we're doing right at the end now. You know, now a couple of days before we pick, so that we get some air into the bunches. But the whole idea of a sort of dappled light effect, you know, was quite new. I mean, Bordeaux, France doesn't have a word for canopy management. You know? Yeah. So all that has come into effect and is being used. And I definitely believe that what we can do with vineyard management is much more valid than what we can do, say, by planting other grape varieties like Tempranillo or Syrah or things like that.
Make the most of what you've got, in a way.
Exactly.
Farm it differently, yeah?
Exactly. And observe. But we are doing so much cooperation with other estates around and lots of research and lots of what-ifs. And so it's exciting times, but we're on our toes. We're not there yet. Are we worried? Yes.
Hmm.
Are we reacting? Yes.
Hmm. And I think Bordeaux's always got the scientific base to what it does, partly because of how amazing the university is, which may be more so than Burgundy. I mean, Dijon University is obviously a very good university as well, but yeah. Maybe it's not quite as involved in the wine region as Bordeaux University is.
Well, we've got one of the absolute stars of the Bordeaux University called Axel Marchal, who was Denis Dubuque's sort of star pupil.
Yeah.
In fact, he'd be a great person for you to talk to at some stage. And he's actually advising us for Castillon. And what I love is the empiric knowledge coupled with the research.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
And I mean, it blows my mind. I learn so much every time I'm walking around the vineyards with it.
It's a great combination, isn't it?
Yeah.
Listen, I want to talk to you a little bit about En Primeur, this system of futures, where a lot of wines in Bordeaux are sold while they're still in barrel. I mean, I just wondered, do you think the system is still as relevant as it once was? Or have you guys thought of doing what we might call a Latour, a Chateau Latour, releasing your wines later and leaving the system?
God, no, we haven't got enough wine to sell. And we haven't got enough money to stock it. No way. I mean, you know, we're talking about 5,000, 6,000 bottles of wine a year.
Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons why En Primeur works so well with right bank properties and why you never see or you hardly ever see right bank properties on Livex being changed because they're all bought En Primeur and then they stay. They don't get traded as much.
People drink them, right?
Yeah, or they leave them in their cells. I mean, when you think of 5,000 bottles in most, in a small estate in Pomerol or Saint Emilion, compared to 50 to 100,000 bottles in the Medoc, you know, I think people have to stop and think about that for a moment, the sheer mass. And for us, it works. It works well because it's the fairest way of us managing to parcel out our production around the world.
Yeah.
To answer the first part of your question, does En Primeur still work? Well, if in case you hadn't noticed, the wine business has got so much bigger than it was 15, 20 years ago. I mean, we have demands from people from Azerbaijan to Argentina to all over the world wanting to drink each other's wines. If we wanted to, we could just sell all of our wines just doing exchanges with our fellow winemakers around the world.
You'd have a very good seller, wouldn't you?
The sommeliers might have a question about that. But, you know, the En Primeur works because of the sheer size of a global fine wine market today.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I mean, you live in Belgium a lot of the time, but you travel regularly to Bordeaux and obviously have a house there to work at the three estates. I mean, but post-Brexit, I know you see yourself, as I do myself, as even more of a kind of citizen of the world. I mean, does living outside France give you a different perspective on Bordeaux, do you think?
Oh, God, I'm not in the panier de crab, the crab basket. Jack and I are always amazed when we're in Bordeaux that the conversation is all about wine.
Yeah.
And we say, thank goodness we don't live full time. It's very unfair to our Bordeaux friends, but it is a lot about wine and wine gossip. Mm. And I think the great thing is that we live outside, so we've got lots of other interests. Talking about Brexit, I think that the one thing that I did post-Brexit was become a Belgian citizen because I couldn't imagine not being a European. And I think it's one of the absolute humongous mistakes out. But I feel now much more European than I do probably even British.
Yes. I think I do too. I just don't have the passport to prove it.
Yeah, but I mean, it's really sad, sad that. But yes, I'm having a chance to step back makes Bordeaux in perspective and see it from an objective stance, which is really important sometimes because it does get a bit heated up there.
Yeah, I mean, talking about perspective, I think it's very interesting. I mean, your life must appear incredibly glamorous to an outsider. You're attending dinners where some of the greatest wines in the world are served, and you're hobnobbing with the owners of some of Bordeaux's other most famous estates. How do you keep your feet on the ground? I mean, you talked once about being honest to yourself. I mean, is it your sense of humour that keeps you honest to yourself?
Oh, God.
Is it Jacques? Is it your upbringing?
I think it's both of our upbringings. We weren't born like this. We both come from families where you had to work bloody hard to prove yourselves. And I think that, okay, we can put on my glad rags occasionally. Of course, I haven't really done that for 2.5 years, and it's sort of, you know, starting to tell. But it's wonderful to do that occasionally. But most of the time, we're in jeans and wellies. And I can tell you, if you saw us at 9 o'clock on Saturday night, it wasn't exactly very glamorous when we were sort of hosing down a winery and drawing on a good Belgian beer at the end of the day. Don't take yourself too seriously.
Yeah,
it's agriculture, and that's what it's all about. And you and I have a lot of the same friends in the wine business, and all of those friends just really first and foremost. Foremost, they're out in the vineyards. They're farmers, and that is so important. Not taking yourself too seriously is the key number one.
I think that's another good bit of advice to another young person wanting to enter the wine trade, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I see sometimes all these sort of bright young MWs who seem to me sometimes really a bit too earnest and serious and desperate to prove, you know, how much knowledge they have.
Yeah,
I think EMW is a wonderful, wonderful qualification, but you know, it's a passport to the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And huge respect because it's probably 100 times more difficult than it was when I first passed.
Let's talk about that quickly, because you passed in what, 94, didn't you?
Yeah, I think yeah. I think I was one of the first 20 women to get it. God, that makes me sound old.
Why did you do it? Because it was there? It was like Everest.
I was working for Seagram Chateau and Estates in New York in the Seagram building. And Jancis Robinson and Michael Broadbent came over to launch the Masters of Wine in the US. And they went to see Ab Simon and said, could we do it in your Seagram premises? And I said, yes, of course. And Fiona will help you do it. And of course, they told me the biggest lie in the wine world. Darlings, why don't you do it? It's easy. You could do it. Here's a reading list. So encouraged by their words, I said, okay, next year I'm going to do it. And of course, fell flat on my face, which I was actually rather a good student at university. And I have quite a few different degrees and things. So it was the first time I had really failed so miserably. So that made me really angry. It did take me 4 years. During the time I moved from New York to Paris, but it certainly is quite a challenge. Whenever you took it,
I think having your writing skills helped. I mean, you know, you're very modest about this, but you're also an award-winning writer and journalist, as well as a wine producer and trader as well. You sell wine. Do you think being a writer helps you to see things from our side, from the journalist side, as it were, because you're kind of one of us, really. You often go round with us in the bus during on pre-modes. Does it make you respect writers a bit more? The good ones.
Oh, good, I love writers. Yeah. I mean, I hate tasting notes. Yeah. But don't we all?
Writing them.
Well, I hate writing. I mean, no, actually, I've just finished doing this review for this book by Maurice Healy called Stay Me with Flagons, that's going to be published by the Académie du Vin Library. And it is the most wonderful book. You don't know what grape variety it is, how the wine is made, but the emotions and the metaphors are just so beautiful. You know exactly how the wine tastes.
Yeah.
And I think I do quite a lot of writing workshops anyway, about not about wine, but in general. And I think it's really freed me up to not write as if I was doing a wine guide.
Yeah.
And I think we've, you know, maybe when we, I think you is the same, you have that lovely conversational way of writing.
Yeah.
And sometimes we have to get out of our MW specialized little zone and realize who we're talking to, and realizing that synonyms and metaphors are actually what people really want, because they, you know, you've seen this, but traveling to Asia, when you're talking about cat's pee or box tree or asparagus, you know, no one knows what the hell you're talking about.
They don't get it.
I know they don't get it at all. And you know, it's emotions and stories are so much more powerful to convey what we want, and we should actually take an example from food writers because they do better than we do.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, Sometimes you start in that rather stiff way, but I don't care about what grapes are in, you know, a certain wine. You should be able to taste them anyway. It's what, oh, haven't you noticed how we all nowadays talk more about texture in wines as a quality description than the actual taste? You know, the emotions that the texture of a wine in your mouth gives you is so much more important. So yes, I love wine writers. Yeah. I feel an honorary member of a club, and a lot of my friends. I've got some great pictures of us 20 years ago, you know, when we were tasting wines together. But
well, we're happy to have you. You're welcome in our club.
And it's good fun.
Yeah. I mean, your most recent book, which I love, is 10 Great Wine Families of Europe. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just wonder, how did you choose the families? And did anybody say, oh, no, thanks, we don't want you digging into what we're up to?
Well, no, that's why I chose friends.
Yeah. Okay.
If I were going to write a book about wine, it's not going to be a decanter article. It's got to dig deep. And I had, during the lockdown, I had all 10 of them on a webinar.
Together?
Which is hilarious. I think it was for the Masters of Wine. I think it's still there. And it was hilarious. It was like trying to get Alvaro Palacios and Leonardo Lamberto Frescobaldi to stop talking so much. I mean, it was like this. But, you know, they all told me that I'd been very, very naughty because I had told, you know, the most innermost secrets with them. But I insisted on staying with them. Often I stayed up late at night drinking far too much wine. They all got to see the articles beforehand. But what I really wanted to focus on was the inner tensions of being a wine family and having to pass that down to subsequent generations. Yes. So everyone was a fourth generation, at least. And that was the thread that went through the book. And because I knew them all so well, and I was also part of that sort of club as well, because we exchange wines and we talk about wines a lot, they trusted me.
But that's very important, isn't it? That they'll tell you things.
Yeah. And if there are things in the book which they certainly never told anyone else. And I also allowed myself to describe them in a very honest, not in a sort of hagiography way.
It wasn't a hello article, was it?
It wasn't a decanter or hello article. I think I was brutally honest about the challenges facing each family business. Family. I mean, Napoleon has got a lot to answer for.
Well, the Napoleonic code, where estates are divided equally amongst children, poses enormous problems for producers, particularly in France, doesn't it? I mean, Spain, it's a bit better. I don't know about Italy, but it's certainly very bad in France.
It's very bad in France. In Germany, it's less bad. But in a lot of Europe, in Burgundy, especially when the domains are so small. Yeah. And I mean, in Bordeaux as well, we are in the process at the moment with the Tiampon family, with our family, looking at the next generation and how we're going to do it. And for example, at Vieux Château Sertan, there are, I think, more than 100 different shareholders.
Oof.
Yeah.
So, I mean, are they an endangered species? Do you think these sort of top family-owned estates? I mean, there are so many people around the world, you mentioned this earlier, with lots of money. The wine trade has gone global. There are, I don't know how many millionaires and billionaires out there who think, oh, I quite fancy owning a Burgundian estate or a Bordeaux chateau.
It is a bit of a risk, certainly. And people who do sell, have very valid reasons for doing so. So you shouldn't sort of cast aspersions on them for having done so. And sometimes the big companies who take over have really lifted up the property.
AXA well, look, being a good
exactly,
example.
Look at some, the big companies, AXA or LVMH and things like that. So it can't be black and white. But it is true that there is a special touch, a sensibility of being a family-owned company, which is maybe romantic, which maybe has nothing to do with the quality of a wine, but certainly is comforting in a business like the wine business.
Was that the thing you found they all shared, that sort of sensibility?
Yes, absolutely. That's what all their actions were geared towards, being the link in a very long chain. And even today, what we are making decisions are are not for what we're going to do with this harvest, but what we're going to do for the next generation behind us, whether it's planting hedgerows and fruit trees for biodiversity or looking at other grape varieties or whatever. But, you know, when you are not having to satisfy the accountants, you can have a much more longer term outlook.
Yeah, I think that's the key advantage that families have, as long as the family gets on okay.
And you have to work at that. You really do. Yeah.
Well, as you do with any relationship, right?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. You know. Yeah, but just because you're a cousin or a brother or a sister or a wife doesn't mean that it makes it much easier. Yeah. Sometimes.
You obviously got these three estates in Bordeaux, and you've got a lot on your plate up in Belgium, running the wine business as well. You're heavily involved, or have been, in the Institute of Masters of Wine. I've given over. I mean, is there anywhere else in the world where you'd like to make wine? I just wonder, have you and Jacques been offered a sneaky joint venture anywhere?
Lots. But I mean, no, I think we're both modest enough to know that, you know, you stick with what you're good at. I think with climate change, I think Belgium, we've got several friends who are making some really beautiful wines in Belgium. And there is a spot not very far from where we live that is a lovely amphitheater, but it's not going to be for Jacques and I. The kids can do it if they want to.
Encourage them to plant it?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But if they want to.
With what, Merlot?
No, we're definitely Chardonnay Pinot Noir. But yeah. I think the mistake that some people did in northern climes, whether it's in England or in Belgium or in Luxembourg or wherever, was to go for hybrid grape varieties.
Yeah.
And I think that's a mistake. I think, you know, noble varieties.
Yeah, we're not going to see Belgium's first Sauvignon Blanc, then, are we?
No, and I think in England this has happened. And you know what I love is when you talk to Klaus Peter Keller and he's planting Riesling up in. I mean, come on, this is great.
But the wine world needs people like that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Final question: you're one of the busiest and most energetic people I know. I think actually, I mean, apart from your family and wine, do you have time for anything else?
Try and do lots of sport, so lots of cycling, swimming, skiing, bit of sailing. And Jacques and I adore two things. One is architecture. I mean, crazy about architecture. We'll go drive a long way out of the way just to go and see a certain chapel or a building or anything. And opera. I adore opera. And someone like Jean-Pierre Perrin, who I absolutely adore, is a great, great music lover. And he's taught me quite a lot. I love opera, I love music, try not wear my headphones to all the time, but I could quite happily be, you know, in the vineyards, you know, with Parsifal.
And well, I've got to say, you've discovered Wagner fairly recently, haven't you?
Yeah, that's age. Actually, that's Jean-Pierre. Jean-Pierre put me onto Wagner. No, I mean, you know, you have to graduate from Verdi someday.
Exactly. Sort of Verdi and Mozart, and then eventually you end up with Wagner. Right?
Exactly.
Anyway, listen, Fiona, it's been fantastic talking to you. Good luck with the rest of the harvest. Yeah.
Thank you.
Hoping that the weather gods smile upon you. May your wellies be forever covered in mud, but the right type.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, I'd like them to be covered a bit with dust in the next few days. So we'll hope for that. Tim, I look forward very much to the day we can actually see each other again. I can give you a big hug. But lovely talking to you.
It's been fantastic.
See you
soon.
Sorry, Randall, that's wine. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
It's always a pleasure to catch up with Fiona. Truly one of my favourite people. Next week on Cork Talk, my guest is the legendary Brian Crozer of Tapa Napa in Australia. See you then. Thanks for listening to Cork Talk. If you want to read more reports, articles and tasting notes by me, go to my website, timatkin.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, @timatkin, and on Instagram, @timatkinmw. See you next week.